Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, poverty reduction and care for the environment top the agenda as Caritas Internationalis holds its General Assembly here in the Vatican this week. Why European governments are pushing undocumented migrants into poverty and crime. But first, Pope Benedict canonizes four new saints as models of compassion and fidelity to the gospel. Welcome to the programme. The presidents of Ireland, Malta, Poland and the Philippines were among thousands of pilgrims gathered in St. Peter's Square on Sunday as Pope Benedict celebrated Mass for the canonization of four new saints. Despite the pouring rain, the crowds of faithful came from countries across the world where these four men and women had ministered, preached and founded religious houses. My colleague Emma McCarthy takes a closer look.
The rite of canonization preceded the Mass, where Prefect of the Congregation for the Cause of the Saints, Cardinal Sir Ivor Martins, accompanied the postulators for each of the saints' causes before the Holy Father. There, to the tones of the Litany of the Saints, the Cardinal asked for the names of Simon of Lipnica, a monk who lived in 15th century Poland, Charles of St. Andrew, a Dutch preacher who worked in Ireland, where he was known as Charles of Mount Argus, Anne-Marie Eugénie, who gave her life to religious teaching in 19th century France, and Maltese preacher George Preca, who died in 1962, to be written in the roll of the saints and proclaimed saints throughout the entire church, to which Pope Benedict replied, "It will so be ordered."
Decernimus. Giorgio Preca.
The Pope then went on to reflect on the character and work of the four new saints, whom he described as exemplary witnesses of the gospel. Beginning with Malta's first son to become a saint, the Pope said, as a priest, Father George Preca dedicated himself entirely to evangelization through preaching, writing, catechesis, the administration of the sacraments, but first and foremost through his example and his way of life.
Novi Sventi, Simon Lipnici.
The Pope Simon of Lipnica was filled by the mercy of the Blessed Sacrament and did not hesitate to come to the help of the sick and the dying of the plague, countering that disease which in the end would bring about his own death. Today, continued Pope Benedict, we entrust all those who suffer from poverty and disease, loneliness and social injustice to his care.
Marie Eugénie Milleret.
In his reflections on the foundress of the Assumptionist Order, Marie Eugénie Milleret, the Pope underlined her strong bond with the Eucharist. She perceived the importance of transmitting the faith to younger generations, informing them intellectually, spiritually and morally for their future. The Pope then presented the figure of the Passionist priest, Karl van Sant Andres Huben, also known as Charles of Mount Argus.
During his many years of priestly ministry in England and Ireland, the people flocked to him to seek out his wise counsel, his compassionate care and his healing touch. In the sick and the suffering, he recognized the face of the crucified Christ, to whom he had a lifelong devotion.
Cardinals, bishops and priests from across the world participated in Sunday's ceremonies, as well as the presidents of Ireland, Malta, Poland and the Philippines. Among them was Passionist priest Father Patrick Rogers. From the monastery of Mount Argus in Dublin, where St. Charles lived, worked and today lies buried.
But he was a wonderful consoler, so all kinds of people came to him to be blessed. The devotion to us continued, and of course it's a huge celebration in Ireland because he's the first Irish saint canonized for many years. Even though he was from Holland, we took him to to our own, and so we regard him as an honorary Irishman.
At the end of the celebration, Pope Benedict XVI greeted those present in different languages, including English.
Especially those who have come to Rome in such great numbers from Malta, Ireland and Great Britain. Complimenti.
In off-the-cuff comments in Italian, Pope Benedict also thanked the pilgrims and visitors for their patience, for having withstood the relentless rain. But water, said the Pope with a smile, is a precious gift, and so we must also give praise to God for this water. The faithful loudly applauded, waving flags, hats and rain-drenched umbrellas.
And may God bless you all.
And my thanks there to Emma McCarthy for that report. The Global Catholic Aid and Development Confederation, Caritas Internationalis, opened its General Assembly in the Vatican on Sunday. The six-day meeting brings together hundreds of delegates from local Caritas groups throughout the world who are meeting to discuss challenges facing the humanitarian and development communities. Duncan McLaren is Secretary General of the Caritas Confederation. He tells us more about the theme of this General Assembly.
We have a draft strategic framework which we will work on, and at the end of the day that will then become the Confederation work plan. And the main items in that are building sustainable peace, our integral human development, improving the way we work in emergencies, and then improving the structures of Caritas so that it become more relevant to the world of the poor today. Also in our assembly, of course, we have liturgical celebrations every day, and each region of Caritas takes over one of those. So we see how people express their faith from all over the world. And a very important moment, of course, will be the moment with Pope Benedict when he meets all the delegates, because the Pope's first encyclical, Deus Caritas Est, has inspired the theme of the assembly, Witnesses to Charity, Builders of Peace, and that encyclical, in fact, will permeate the spirit of the Assembly.
Significantly, the General Assembly this year coincides with the summit of leaders of the G8 countries in Heiligendamm, Germany, this week. Caritas President Denis Vianneau says Caritas is using this coincidence to highlight its campaign drawing attention to the failures of the world's richest countries to live up to their promises on development aid to the poor.
Caritas Internationalis started a few months ago a campaign at the occasion of this G8 meeting where we insist on some points mostly linked to the financing of the development. The main idea is about the percentage concerning the overseas development aid. You know that the countries, rich countries, have decided to try to achieve in the few years the figure of 0.51%, and the goal is 7%, that's clear. So this is part of the, let's say, the debate we have. What I like to say that there is some kind of not a contradiction, but a double image, a double face of the coin, you know, between the G8 meeting this week in Germany and this meeting. So some kind of a double image of the world today, the rich people and the poor people. So, and we Caritas are belonging to the second part of the world, that's clear, to support. And I would like to insist on the empowerment. I think we, even if we don't have one penny, we can do something. We will discuss in Germany about huge amount of money. So isn't it a question also of analyzing the way we are living on this earth? How we are going to change our ways of consumption, our habits of life.
Another keynote speaker at the General Assembly opening session was Nobel Peace Laureate Wangari Maathai of Kenya, recognised for her persistent struggle for democracy, human rights and environmental conservation. Mrs. Maathai won acclaim for founding the Green Belt Movement, a grassroots initiative that relies on rural African women to plant trees to combat deforestation and desertification. As a young Catholic girl, she served in the Legion of Mary, where she was involved in charitable projects to help the sick and destitute. Speaking in the Vatican Synod Hall, she began by paying tribute to the important role played by Caritas in the fight against global poverty.
As we all know, the work of the Caritas Internationalis everywhere in the world is mainly to address the concerns and the needs of the weak, the vulnerable, the poor, the marginalized, to provide humanitarian needs to those who need it. And my message this morning was to say that this is a very important work that Caritas Internationalis does, but that we also need to look at the causes of poverty, especially since we notice that the gap between the rich and the poor continues to rise. So I wanted to encourage us, I say us because I'm also involved in the same work, to look at the causes. And one of the causes is, of course, the political and economic injustice or unjust systems that we have in place that we try to change both at the local level and at the global level. And so I emphasized that even as we work with the poor, for the poor, we need to empower them. And this empowerment can be through education, through training, especially investing in women, in youth, so that they can get the tools with which they can liberate themselves from poverty. I also drew attention to the fact that there is a very close linkage between the way we manage our resources, the way we share them, and the way that promotes to peace or wars. And I concluded by using the story of Peter and John in Acts chapter 3, which is a call to empower the poor, as Peter and John empowered the beggar at the synagogue. That while we work for the poor, we need to empower them so that they can rise up, liberate themselves, and give themselves the dignity and the respect that poverty denies them.
Underlining the link between environmental protection and overcoming poverty, Mrs. Mathai urged all Caritas members to embrace an environmental agenda through projects as simple as tree planting programs at local parish level.
I think from this level of Caritas Internationalis and at this General Assembly, it is possible for them to prioritize the environment and decide that as they go out to the world and to the grassroots, since at the local level they actually work at the parish level, that they will embrace environmental protection. One very action-oriented commitment they could make is to promote tree planting at parish level with the faithful. And this is doable throughout the world. And because of the global warming, we need not only the protection, not only the planting of trees, but also the protection of studding trees, the protection of forests. And I think that the church in general can make a commitment to ensure that forests are protected. And this is especially important in areas like Africa, Latin America, Southeast Asia, where we have the major forest ecosystems that are very important for global warming, but which are also very threatened by exploitation, mainly from the northern countries, which are, as we know, the main contributors of the greenhouse gases. So we need this partnership, and they are in a position where they can engage G8, and especially during this meeting in Germany, to have these G8 countries commit to help, not only at the global level, but also at the local level. It's also possible to engage the G8 countries in terms of agreeing on policies that they want to put in place in order to reduce the emissions in the industrialized countries. On a light touch, I asked the delegates to plant trees so that they can make their conference carbon neutral by planting at least 80 trees if you came from Africa, 10 trees if you come from very far like Australia, and I guess those who came from Europe can plant anything between 5 and 6 there. I think that will make their journey carbon-free. It's a way of raising awareness. It doesn't really make that much difference, but it's a way of raising awareness and ensuring that this is not something that is out there in the far from us, that it is something that has to touch our lives every day, that we as individuals have to change our lifestyles, the way we live every day.
Nobel Peace Laureate Wangari Maathai speaking at the opening of the Caritas Internationalis General Assembly. And earlier you heard Duncan McLaren and Denis Vianneau, Secretary General and President of the Caritas Confederation. Condemned to live in a legal no-man's land, to be sucked slowly into a dark underworld of poverty, prostitution and crime. That's the fate being forced upon millions of migrant workers across Europe by governments that refuse to recognise their presence or guarantee them basic rights and services. These carefully documented accusations are contained in a recent report from the Jesuit Refugee Service, which works with migrant communities in countries across Europe. The report, presented on May 15th in Brussels, says government policies limiting access to healthcare, housing, education, employment and social benefits have driven many undocumented migrants into destitution, depression and desperation.
The young girls released from the detention centre without any right to work end up in the quarter of the town in the red light district. We know that in the Netherlands, outside the detention centres, people are sometimes put on the street by 4-5 in the afternoon. There are pimps coming to look for workers.
Father Jan Stout is director of the Brussels-based European Office for the Jesuit Refugee Service, which is active in over 50 countries worldwide. He says migrant workers are an increasingly necessary part of our European economies, and it's essential that governments act now to provide basic rights and services to these people.
Yes, there are in Europe about... The estimates are between 4 and 8 million people without the right documentation. And some of these people are really on the brink of extreme, extreme poverty. And this is policy induced. Some governments on purpose withhold rights from these people to go to school, to have health care, to work, and social benefits. Well, they end up, it's an invitation to crime. And the hypothesis was that if we make life difficult enough for them, they will go home. And our report shows that does not work. You cannot starve them home. People get depressed, people get discouraged, people get an enormous distrust towards every authority. And many of these people are asylum seekers whose claim has not been accepted, which of course happens. I mean, I don't argue with that. Not everybody who is an asylum seeker rightly asked for asylum. It is not surprising that 2/3 are rejected. But then, people should be sent home. And that is also something that we are not opposing in principle. But then the reality is that a large group cannot be sent home for health reasons, because they have family members here who are allowed to stay. Or an independent judge says the administration has made a mistake, this person is, at the present circumstances, in great danger when he returns to Iraq or Afghanistan. So, for objective reasons, people cannot return, and still the government doesn't give them any legal residence rights, and then they end up in extreme poverty.
So this is what you're asking the governments of Europe for, to somehow define the status of these people in whatever particular phase they may be of their
yes.
request for asylum.
At present, they are falling through the cracks of the system. And the social inclusion in policies exclude those who do not have residence rights. So what we are asking is to just not tolerate the presence of these people, but accept that they are not going back and give them a status. And if they can be returned, return them. And if they cannot return, accept the fact that it is not possible.
In which countries is this problem most serious, do you think, or which countries?
It is very much happening in Great Britain. There you have an action called Strangers, a campaign called Strangers to Citizens from Refugee Action. There is a campaign called Just Fair from the British Refugee Council. There are big numbers there. There are big numbers in Germany, where they have invented a word, Duldung, toleration without rights. It is not so much a problem, as our research has shown, in countries like Slovenia. There was not, or in Ireland. It also has to do with the fact that in Spain and Ireland there's plenty of work, and even those people who do not have the right documentation can find work.
You're saying that this denying people of their rights is an invitation to crime. How are a lot of these people surviving? How, when you talk about being destitute, how are they finding enough to survive on?
They become very dependent on church charities, on friends, and live from day to day, hand to mouth, the expression, I believe, without knowing what 2 days later will happen. But we have seen it on Malta, that the people, the young girls released from the detention center without any right to work, end up in the quarter of the town in the red light district. And we know that in the Netherlands, outside the detention centers, people are sometimes put on the street by 4, 5 in the afternoon. There are pimps coming to look for workers.
Are you working as JRS with some of these people to try and help them find a better way of surviving in these difficult conditions?
The short answer is no, because it is very difficult to find them, and it is in some countries forbidden to work with illegal residents. It's illegal to support illegally staying people. But we have a strong presence in the detention centers all over Europe. And it is because in the past 10 years, social services hardly exist, but most European laws guarantee the presence of priests or pastors. So the Jesuits have been entering with their lay colleagues into the detention centers for pastoral care. And when these people are released from the detention center without being sent back, they don't know where to go, but they remember the Jesuit Refugee Service who came to see them, and they find it in the telephone directory, and then they end up on our doorstep. And in London, the first thing we do is give them a meal.
And then?
And then we, another item that we distribute often is telephone cards. That people can telephone their relatives, and then the network of distant relatives and people from the same country will take care of them. And very often they disappear and we don't know where they are.
The problem behind this, of course, is the government's reluctance to provide rights to these people. Is this somehow this fear of being swamped by immigrants coming in from the developing countries, particularly, or Eastern Europe as well? What can you do, perhaps, to try and alert public opinion to the seriousness of this problem and the need to really reach out and help these people?
The actual approach from the European government is completely unrealistic. They, with lots of noise and fanfare, they talk about the agency Frontex that guards the European frontiers in the east, Poland, Slovakia, Hungary, in the south, Canary Islands, Lampedusa. But a far greater number of people enter Europe completely legally on a student visa or a short-time tourist visa and overstay their visa and then find work in Spain and in Italy. There is work. Europe can at present absorb 300,000 workers a year. We need 300,000 workers a year. And the European Commission will publish shortly in the Green Book about this migration issue. We expect it within 3 weeks. And the problem is that the regulations concentrate very much on high-skilled workers, like academics or intra-company transfers, you know, that you for Shell company or for British Petrol, you move from one country to another. But it hardly addresses the low-skilled workers. And Spain and Italy need the low-skilled workers for the farms. So the funny thing is that on the one hand, we need migrants, and on the other hand, we are keeping them out. And that is because there is at present not really a possibility for a visa for short-term work. And that would be the ideal thing. Give people a work permit for 2 years or 3 years. Because once a person is here and doesn't have the right papers, he will never go back. because he cannot cross the border and he is afraid that he cannot come back to the country where he is working. If you give him a work permit, he will certainly go back to see his family or to build his family house or to help his mother in the country where he comes from. So the irony is that denying people travel documents makes that they stay illegally. Well, if you give them travel documents, you can be certain that they will go more frequent home.
How much, though, does the prejudice of people in Europe play into this reluctance of the government to really address the problem, to really tackle these issues?
Slowly we are realising, the policymakers have already realised that we need migration. But in many of the big cities, the original citizens feel uncomfortable when they become a minority in their own area of town. And I fully appreciate that is difficult, certainly when you don't speak the language of the immigrant and when the immigrant community does not do its best to open itself to the people who were there before them. And I think churches or faith-based organizations can play a big role because they are present and in the country of origin and in the country of destination. The example in Europe is, of course, the Polish workers reviving the Irish church, but I celebrate Sunday Masses in Brussels, in English churches, and then in front of me I have people from Nigeria, from the Philippines, from Hungary, from Slovakia. And they are, during that 1 hour celebration, very well integrated and talk to each other before Mass and after Mass. We have readers from all continents, and I think that churches can be a great tool for integration. The Filipinos are an excellent example. Yes, but I do, to come back to your question, I wouldn't say that there's a prejudice, but it is all going very fast, migration. So I can understand that it's difficult for people, but there is no denying it. Europe is immigration country for the first time since the Second World War.
And my thanks there to Father Jan Stout, European Director for the Jesuit Refugee Service. Thanks to Susie Hodges for her help on today's programme. That's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Don't forget, we'll be back on the air at this same time tomorrow, and you can always find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org/English. Now stay tuned. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.